Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots. Hello, and welcome to the third episode of the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots. I am your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are going with a new one and discussing the 2012 film Prometheus, written by Damon Lindelof and directed by Ridley Scott. Once again, here to discuss the film with me is my buddy, Mr. Sean Stengland.
Howdy.
As I mentioned, we are going to be discussing Prometheus, but before getting into our discussion, we would like to say that we are proud members of the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. All right, Sean, before getting into the discussion, it is not a episode of the Plain Label Podcast without a drink roll call, so what are you drinking tonight?
I am drinking the pride of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, the one and only Leinenkugel's Summer Shandy.
That's not too bad. I've had that before.
Yeah, it's from what I can tell, it's basically the most popular beer in the Chicago suburbs whenever it comes around, because it's everywhere. I went to the White Sox game a few weeks ago, and I swear everyone in our section was drinking Summer Shandy. So Chicago loves Summer Shandy, apparently.
Well, it's alternative to old style, so how can you blame them?
God bless America.
I am going with another wine. It is Columbia Crest Two Vines. It is a red wine, and once again, it does not say what red wines are in it. Apparently, that's my MO. So, all right, with that, why don't we start discussing Prometheus?
A king has his reign.
Civilizations that were separated by centuries, and yet this same pictogram was discovered in every one of them.
They're smiling.
I think they want us to come and find them.
We're all here because of a map you two kids found in a cave.
Not a map, an invitation.
From whom?
Please tell me you can read that.
Prometheus, are you seeing this?
Whatever that probe is picking up, it's reading life form.
What do you mean a life form?
Oh, the head.
They're changing.
Changing into what?
It's moving. These things moving.
What is that?
That is a ship.
They're leaving.
To go where?
Earth.
We were so wrong.
Take us home! If you don't stop it, they won't give you hope to go back to.
Why is that door open? Cut it out! Cut it
Ridley Scott, director of Alien and Blade Runner, returns to the genre he helped define. With Prometheus, he creates a groundbreaking mythology in which a team of explorers discover a clue to the origins of mankind on Earth, leading them on a thrilling journey to the darkest corners of the universe. There, they must fight a terrifying battle to save the future of the human race. So, with that being said, Sean, what did you think, generally, of Prometheus?
I came out of the theater loving almost all of it and absolutely hating the last 5 minutes.
Mm.
That was my immediate reaction.
Hmm.
Then the days went on, and I thought about the movie more, and then I started to hate all of it.
Okay.
Then another day would go by, and I started making, I don't know if I'd say I was making excuses for the things I didn't like about it, or finding reasons to look past them. And then I was back to saying, no, it's brilliant. It's the best movie I've seen all year. Mm-hmm. And this movie is very divisive. The dialogue about this movie on the internet and just among everyone who's seen it has been really interesting. And just whether or not you like this movie, you have to admit that it's working on some level if you're talking about it. And we're talking about it now. And it's been out for almost a month now.
Mm-hmm.
And I still am talking about it with people at work and trying to figure out, does it mean anything? Are there secrets to unlock, or is it all just smoke and mirrors? It's not a movie that you can easily discount, and you can't say that about a lot of tentpole Hollywood releases.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's a summer release, and generally the movies in the summer, especially of this genre, are very kick back and don't think. And that's not the sort of movie that this is at all. It strikes me as more of like a fall or winter release sort of a film.
You know? I did think it was strange when I saw the first trailer that it was coming out in June. It seems like a perfect October release. Maybe not a Halloween release, because I think Saw and Paranormal Activity have kind of made people expect certain things about movies that come out of Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
But this definitely is not a rock'em sock'em good time at the movies.
Yeah, it's not like Real Steel.
Right? No. No, not at all.
So yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I guess for those that don't know, the general idea is that the beginning of the year is kind of your dumping ground. The middle is your summer blockbuster. The end of the year is generally your more Oscar bait and thinking type movies. And I mean, there's obvious exceptions, and there's independent movies and that sort of thing, but that's sort of the way that it goes usually.
And I think that the summer release, more than anything, speaks to Fox's desire to capture an audience that perhaps wouldn't normally have seen this,
mm-hmm.
because they needed to justify their budget and hopefully make another one.
Sure.
And I think the estimates of the budget I've seen in this movie are right around 120 to 130 million, and I think it just passed 120.
120 like, domestic?
120 domestic.
Okay, then it should be doing fine.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to be enough to justify launching another huge science fiction movie with Ridley Scott directing and giving him another big payday, but I think it's doing better than a lot of people had thought. I saw R-rated horror movie in the summer. I wouldn't have been shocked if it didn't even hit 100 million,
mm-hmm.
but it did, and a lot of that I'm sure is because it's playing mostly in 3D theaters, at least for the first couple weeks.
Now, did you see it in 3D?
I've seen it twice, and I saw neither time in 3D, which I've heard that this is one of the rare movies where the 3D is actually worth seeing.
Really?
So I take it you didn't see it in 3D.
No.
Okay.
No, see, I sort of as a rule don't go to them in 3D.
Yeah.
Besides the, we can get into the actual movie in just a second, but besides the actual, like, depth of field and the sort of, I don't know, map paintings or CGI or whatever for the world,
mm-hmm.
I don't really understand what the depth or the 3D would have given you. I mean, I guess there's the creatures later on that maybe would be interesting in 3D, but I don't know. It didn't strike me as a 3D movie, really.
Yeah, to me, the only parts of it, it's all in the beginning, I would think, where the 3D would be interesting as far as when they're approaching the planet and landing on it, and the beauty shots of the interior of the Prometheus when David is the only person awake on it.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I don't know how it would help. There's a scene in the middle of this movie that's extremely claustrophobic. And I don't know how that would work in 3D, if that would heighten the claustrophobia. It did work in the Titanic 3D release, where in the latter half of the movie the water was always above your head, basically. It always felt like you were underwater at the end of that movie. And
oh,
that
really?
I really thought that the 3D helped the latter half of Titanic as far as selling the claustrophobia. Because you really felt it. And I don't know if the same effect would work in this movie in that one little minute-long stretch.
Sure.
But that's, you know, I nothing about this movie screams you have to see this in 3D to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, because I was kind of expecting more science fiction and horror and less, you know, Spider-Man and Avengers. So I didn't expect a lot of bombast and a lot of things being thrown at me that you would dodge in 3D and that sort of thing.
Exactly. So. Well, and that's the argument with 3D. Is it more effective when things are popping out at you or when it's like looking through a window? And I think James Cameron knows how to do that better than anybody. He's kind of proven that, and I haven't seen anything that really comes close to that yet.
Mm. All right, well, let's get into the actual film. One of the things that I have written down that was very striking from the beginning that we sort of touched on quickly was, for me, the visuals at the beginning, I was really excited about the movie just based on, not the very beginning, but the once they start landing on the planet.
Right.
And they start showing the different, you know, vistas or what have you. I was like, well, goddamn, you know, this is really nice looking, you know. And I kept that sort of feeling going throughout the movie to the word the movie looked really good to me, I thought.
Yeah, I think particularly the first 20 minutes or so, and not just approaching the planet. One of my favorite parts of the entire movie is the opening sequence where they have these shots. I think they were filmed in Iceland that are meant to stand in for an ancient planet that they don't tell you is Earth, but you can infer it. And then you see an alien basically plant the seeds of life on this planet. And all that stuff, it was just filmed so beautifully. And the score in the beginning is not like anything I would have expected from a movie like this. It's kind of hopeful and... I think the score is actually problematic because it's not appropriate at times.
Mm.
But in that opening sequence, it seems to promise a different movie than what we get.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could say that the whole opening act kind of promises a different movie than what we get.
Now, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, and this we could discuss this at length, but it's just a question. If you didn't know that this movie was related to Alien, would you even realize that it was supposed to be a horror movie?
No.
Yeah. Like, not until the claustrophobic scene that I was alluding to earlier, then you, this is a horror movie.
Mm-hmm. Not until you're like, oh, yeah. No. You know, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So going back to the very beginning, now, what did you immediately figure out that was, or, I mean, to me, it's got to be Earth, right?
I would think so, and Ridley Scott has been very forthcoming when in answering questions about this movie after its release, and he has said that it doesn't matter what planet it is, which is a total cop-out answer. But yeah, I mean, it's basically here's what we see the engineers who are the aliens in this story. We see one of them drink this black goo, and his body breaks up, and you see DNA strands sort of breaking and splitting off into this ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like he's planting the seeds of life.
All that I liked fine and dandy, but why CGI?
CGI in what sense?
In the creature himself at the very beginning. Well, I guess that character in general. I didn't enjoy the fact that he was like so obviously not a person, like that it was obviously such a CGI character, and you know he's got his muscles on muscles on muscles,
right?
And he just looked like fake to me.
That's interesting that you would say that because I liked it because it looked to me it didn't look like CGI. It looked like a very complicated makeup.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I didn't see that at all.
Wow.
Huh. Because I saw him, and I was seeing it, I guess it was the musculature of it is what did it to me.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, this guy is ridiculous. Like, I guess it sort of looks like the little ab suits from 300.
Yeah, even something maybe building on the kind of makeup they would use in something like Hellboy, almost.
Mm, okay. And so I can see that, but, and then, you know, he obviously, they obviously have to, I mean, they have to use it for when the underwater sequence and his legs falling off and all that sort of thing. But, but I'm watching that going, and I just kind of got wary from the beginning. Like, I don't know. Like, is it going to really be heavily relied upon CGI? And that's not really the Ridley Scott that I'm accustomed to.
Right.
And so I was like, I don't know if he really plays well in that sort of arena. Like, that's more of a James Cameron sort of a situation.
Well, yeah, and the one time really that Ridley Scott has made a movie where the CGI is obvious was Gladiator, and that ruined the movie for some people. It's one of my favorite films of all time, but I remember Roger Ebert could not get past how phony a lot of it looked. And that was really the first time that Ridley Scott had made a movie with such extensive CGI.
Is he just talking about, like, the stadium? Do you remember?
Yeah, he's talking about any of the shots of Rome that were created in the computer.
Yeah, but what does that matter? I mean,
I don't know, but I just remember he got hung up on it, and I've heard people complain about it since, but to me that didn't matter.
Yeah.
In that movie.
Well, and I guess in that situation, you know, you're with Russell Crowe from the beginning, and it's all, you know, dark and gritty, and they're at their battle and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then in the middle, they, you know, he's all downtrodden and he's a slave. And then they show the Colosseum and it's nice and shiny and bright and new. And you know that they couldn't recreate that.
Right, exactly.
And to me, this is, you know, it's obviously an exterior somewhere to where they could have had an actor in a suit or in whatever drinking this liquid. And then they could do CGI when it was necessary. But it just felt so light and not real, but not, you know, not like a not of this world fake, but it just felt like a computer made this to me.
See, I thought it was a makeup from the second I saw it, but it's a bit extreme, and I kind of wonder if they were going for kind of a marble or maybe ceramic aesthetic with it. Like he's kind of like a god cut from marble or something.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, like an ancient Greek or Roman sort of carving.
Yeah.
And I think it was the color that really was what set me off. Like,
yeah.
I think that's what I didn't relate to.
If their intention was to have that character look like he did not belong in the environment he was in, then they succeeded admirably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it certainly doesn't look like he belongs there.
Right.
Later on in the movie, when they're inside the engineer's ship, it looks much better then, because I think it's in its native environment. It looks like it's like it belongs.
Mm-hmm. And then again, there, like, I thought it looked much better later. So I agree with you there. But it was I don't know how I want to say that. It's the size of him compared to the rest of them.
Yeah.
And so I looked at it and I kept thinking, that's not a real person. You know, it wasn't like when I watch The Lord of the Rings and you see, you know, someone that's small and then someone that's big and it's, you know, someone on stilts or a real tall guy and then someone that's a midget or what have
right.
you. It didn't seem to be just like a trick of the photography. It just reminded me of, this is not actually happening.
Huh.
And I don't know why that, and it's not like it really took me out of the film. I mean, I really enjoyed the movie. As a whole, but it was just some, I don't know if I was like looking, watching the movie, trying to find things that I didn't, relate with, or that I didn't, you know, enjoy as much as others, but those were just small things that I was like, well, why? I wonder why they did that. Like, I don't know.
I must say I didn't have a problem like that at any point during the movie. There are not many movies like this.
Mm-hmm.
That don't have one shot, at least one shot that totally takes you out of the movie because you can tell how they did it and how it's fake. And to me, this is about as seamless as a science fiction movie as I've seen since probably J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, which I think didn't get really any credit for its special effects. But if you look at that movie, there's not a single shot in J.J. Abrams' Star Trek that looks phony.
Mm-hmm.
It's so well integrated. They spent their money very well on that movie.
Yeah, and that looks great. I hope that they didn't take too much time between the first one and the second one now.
Yeah. Well, and that movie is germane to this discussion because it's co-written by the man who is getting all the blame from people who don't like Prometheus, and that's Damon Lindelof.
Yeah, and you know, he is such a good sport, especially on Twitter. He'll retweet a whole bunch of comments that he gets about this movie and about Lost, and he'll respond to them.
Yeah, and it's like,
you know, he'll say things like, you know, all the seasons of Lost were horseshit or something like that is a thing he'll get. And he'll say, well, don't eat that baby over there or something like that.
Yeah, I saw that. I think he said that yesterday, actually.
Yeah, I think so.
he's a very, very smart person. If you were going to make a list of the people who really know what they're doing as far as embracing social media and how people in the industry should interact with with consumers, he's definitely on the short list. Even he got involved with podcasting during Lost, mm-hmm. where he and his fellow showrunner, Carlton Cuse, would talk to the audience every week after the show and answer questions nebulously, which is which is sort of their deal. Mm-hmm. In this movie, they're asking questions nebulously to the point where you're not sure if they're actually questions or plot holes, and I think this movie has both. Mm-hmm.
So, speaking of Damon Lindelof, let's talk a little bit about the actual script or the story of this movie. So the question of mankind and God and all that sort of thing is sort of your overarching story plot, right?
Yes, and it seems to be Damon Lindelof's primary fascination.
Right. And then in the middle there, it is more of a Ridley Scott creature try to survive kind of a movie, to me. And I feel like I connect a lot better with a guy that has sort of been through the wars and has the experience to know what to give the audience and what works, and has your basically leads the audience into what he wants to lead them into, to where I feel like Ridley Scott is able to say what he wants to say, and Lindelof wants you to sort of actively participate in the discussion.
Yes.
And which is fine, but that's not really a script for a film, I don't feel like.
No, and I think I may have talked about this on our Sunshine episode. This movie is written like a season 2 finale of the show Prometheus. Like, if this movie was the finale, was the spring finale of a show, and you knew it was coming back in the fall, and all your questions would be either be answered or furthered in the season premiere, I don't think there would be any question of the quality of this movie. Mm-hmm. But it's a movie, and I think Damon Lindelof is probably finding out, the more he thinks about it, that you cannot write a movie like you write a TV show, which I'm sure he knew, but when there's no guarantee of a sequel, you can't leave so many things hanging. Not only is there no guarantee of a sequel, but there's almost no strands in this that can be answered by Alien, which was their intention. Lindelof has said that he doesn't want to call it an Alien prequel, because the ending of Prometheus is not the beginning of Alien, and that's certainly the case.
Right.
I mean, there's at least another movie between the two, if not two other movies.
Right, and I didn't look up what sort of years in the films we're talking, but I'm assuming it's a while.
Yeah, I forget that myself.
Yeah, and it's one of those where it doesn't really matter. I mean, obviously this is a spoiler-filled discussion already, but, you know, the ending, while I'm thinking about it, you know, you have your sort of God architect character, and you have your, I mean, do they even have a name? It's like the octopus thing.
Oh, the giant face hugger at the end of the movie?
Right, the humongous face hugger.
Yes, the face huggers who apparently, after evolution, the face huggers got way, way smaller.
And so, you know, in the, not really post-credits, but it's just the sort of epilogue, you get the sort of birth of those two, like the hybrid of those two, which looks, you know, obviously very similar to the Geiger alien.
Yes, the last shot of this movie is an engineer giving birth in the manner of that alien movies give birth to what the internet has dubbed the proto alien, and it does kind of look like a little bipedal dinosaur that has the general characteristics of the xenomorph alien from the other movies.
Mm-hmm. Now is that the part that you didn't like?
Yes. Okay. I felt like that was the most obvious thing you could do to end this movie and was such an obvious plea for more money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just the movie doesn't have an ending. It's that simple. Even if you didn't have that last scene, it still would have ended with our main character, Elizabeth Shaw, played by Noomi Rapace, saying that she's going in search of the engineer planet. And that's not really a satisfying ending either.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really leave me with... The whole thing feels incomplete. I don't know what would have made it a more complete ending, but the one we have is certainly not it.
Right, because you... And I mean, we can backtrack a little bit after this, but you get Shaw's whole journey and her whole basic character arc through this discovery, and then she realizes what it actually is and all that sort of thing. And she has her whole situation with her boyfriend. And then at the end, she sort of decides, well, this was a really good idea. I'm going to keep pressing this issue.
Yes.
All by myself.
Yes. This wonderful space exploration that cost trillions of dollars and killed everyone on board except me.
Yeah.
And to find out that not only doesn't God exist, but God doesn't exist the way I want him to, but he's an alien who wants to kill my entire race.
Right. And so now I'm going to go find him, and then I'm going to do what?
Yeah. What happens from there, we don't know.
Yeah, which is so strange. That's such a strange way to end it. Like, even if they did an ending to where... You know, I don't know. Like, have you thought about how you wished it would have ended at all? Or something as an alternate to how it actually ended?
Honestly, and Lindelof said he doesn't want the ending of this to be the beginning of Alien, but that would have been a more satisfying ending.
Mm.
If we would have seen the birth of the xenomorph characters as we know them and found out who the engineer that we call them engineers, because this movie calls them engineers, but before that they were called the space jockeys, because in Alien we see one of those characters at the helm of the ship that's crashed on LV-426. If we would have seen how that space jockey got there, I think that would have been more satisfying. I think it is interesting to think about if Prometheus doesn't end where Alien begins. That does make it possible that Elizabeth Shaw is the space jockey that we see in Alien, which is an interesting notion, but it like kind of also reeks of fanfic, which at this point it is fanfic to say something like that.
Right. Well, it's one of those things where I sort of wish, I guess I just feel like, and I don't, like, I think Lindelof does fine. I just don't think that it works 100% like he wants it to.
No.
But I think that, for me, it feels like a film where he wrote the script, and before it was okayed, either the studio or him, or he said, oh shit, this is two movies. So we're gonna have to cut this here, and discard this, and we're gonna have to make this into an ending.
It does feel... I'm guessing that there's at least a half hour missing from this movie, if not more.
Well, yeah, I saw a half an hour of additional features is going to be in the Blu-ray. I think they mentioned that not too long ago.
Yeah, which is par for the course with Ridley Scott.
Yeah, I'm so nervous about buying any Ridley Scott DVD. So I'm like, well, I got to get the one that's the right one.
Yeah, he really invented that whole idea, I think. I think he was the first to do that.
Well, and with a million different Blade Runner cuts.
Yeah, and he's really embraced. He's talked about it in interviews before, where he's really embraced the home experience to where he thinks it's the way to watch a movie, basically, because you can get everything that they intended to give you, and not just what the studio chose to give you.
Now, what about Alien? That doesn't have a whole lot added to it.
No, it has a sequence. The biggest sequence added to it is one that doesn't quite jive with the rest of the mythology of the series, where we see that the alien has cocooned Tom Skerritt's character, which makes no sense in the context of that, in the context of how we see the cocoons function in James Cameron's movie.
Right.
Where they cocoon people and then put the eggs near them.
Has there ever been a slimier motherfucker than Tom Skerritt?
He, especially in Contact. Do you remember that? Oh my God, I wanted to punch him in his fucking face in that movie.
I remember him in Contact, in Top Gun, in Alien, and then in the Poison Ivy movie with Drew Barrymore.
Oh my God. Well, I got to go back to watching Showtime in my parents' basement when I shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
I remember that one.
I remember catching that in a hotel room when my parents had already gone asleep when I was on a baseball trip. And was like, ooh, I should not be watching this.
No, but I
got the girl from Roseanne.
Yes, it does. Looking really pissed off the whole time.
Yeah.
Why can't I be like Drew Barrymore?
Nope. Yeah, that was when I was like, Drew Barrymore, all right. Now she's like frumpy.
She is a little frumpy, isn't she?
Yeah, she's like such a hippie, it makes me puke.
She is hippie-ish. She's... I don't dislike Drew Barrymore, and I just don't want to see her anymore.
You own Never Been Kissed, don't you, Sean?
I do not. That movie... If you ever want to see a movie that completely gets the newspaper industry wrong, that's where you go.
I was hoping for an admission there.
No. That movie, okay, I am a copy editor. Mm-hmm. It Never Been Kissed. Drew Barrymore plays a copy editor who has her own office and assistants.
Yeah.
I'd like to see what her paycheck is.
You and Seabrass have that for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have at least four people running around doing everything for me. What the hell does a copy editor need an assistant for? Like, seriously.
All right, so let's go ahead and sort of rewind and talk a little bit about the characters. So we haven't actually, I mean, you did mention Noomi Rapace, but besides her, we do have Michael Fassbender as David, who is your alien franchise computer, or android, or whatever you want to call him.
And this time sharing a name with another famous movie android, and I wonder if that was on purpose.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And you have Elizabeth Shaw, that's who Noomi Rapace is. She is the sort of scientist that her and her boyfriend lead them out into the middle of nowhere. You have Charlize Theron as Meredith Vickers, who is the... I guess she's just like the one in charge. She's not really the pilot, because that's Idris Elba.
No, she represents the Wayland Corporation, and it feels like her character, if any of these characters is on the cutting room floor, it's hers.
Mm.
There has to be at least, I feel like there's at least three or four scenes with her that are missing from this movie.
Really? I really liked her, and we can get into that in just a second.
Oh, she's very good in it, but I just feel like if you have an actress of that caliber in a role that would appear to be that important, her lack of screen time is glaring.
Mm. And then the last of the main characters is Idris Elba as Giannis, I guess.
And yeah, I think his name is actually said two different ways by characters in the movie.
Oh, okay. Well, it just depends on what their accent is then, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
And he's described as the pilot with little to do.
Yes.
He seems like he's on the screen a decent enough time, but he doesn't really do a whole lot.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot missing from him too, especially... I feel like they wanted to establish some kind of past history between his character and Noomi Rapace's character, but it's just not there.
Yeah.
Because towards the end of the movie, they kind of have this very intense kind of heart-to-heart almost.
Yeah, and like an understanding between
yeah,
them.
Yeah, like where is this coming from? And I think even earlier than that, she like puts her hand on his shoulder when they're like coming down to the planet. It seems very familiar and very, you know, intimate in a way that is not hinted at in any other way by the movie.
It could have been one of those things where there's a scene that doesn't work that has a line or two that establishes that they've been together for a long time.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
And it's one of those where you've got to lose the whole scene because it's maybe 10 minutes, but that one line, you know, gets taken out and it affects part of later in the story. But anyway, so he doesn't have a whole lot to do. And I guess for me, that's the main four, really.
Yeah, then just outside that is Logan Marshall Green as Charlie Holloway, who...
The boyfriend,
who has an unbelievable 180 in this movie, where he is arguably more curious than Shaw, the hero, about what's going on this planet and who are these engineers. And they get to this temple where they find the dead bodies of the engineers and these vases of the black goo. And he just kind of decides that they're all dead and this was a waste and we're not going to get any answers. And he just drinks himself into oblivion.
Yeah, he says, this is just another tomb.
Yeah.
And he turned into such a pussy after that.
Yes, he did. That I think that's a perfect way to put it, isn't it?
Yeah, because he was just like, oh, woe is me, and I'm just going to pout, and I'm going to be a little, like, 10-year-old boy. And
yeah, and he's, like, copping an attitude with David, like he's, like, some kind of racist against androids.
Right, that was so strange.
Yeah, I guess it's meant to help set up why David would have impetus to infect Holloway with the alien goo.
Right.
We got to come up with a better term than alien goo, but that's basically what it is.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Which the movie provides. There's a scene that a lot of people kind of glossed over, I think, where David is talking to someone in hypersleep after they've already all woken up. And you find out later who it is. And David gets orders from him, basically, to infect someone from the crew.
Right.
And Holloway gives him that license because David asks, how far are you willing to go? And Holloway says, as far as it takes. Mm-hmm. So that's when David infects him.
Well, let's talk about David. He is, you know, he's the machine. And if you've watched any of the Alien movies, most of the time they're fairly neutral about everything. And then they end up making some sort of, not really like heroic, but some sort of like dramatic act.
Yes.
And then they get their head ripped off.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
That's sort of what happens.
Yeah, Winona Ryder defies the tradition. But that movie, like, we don't even want to talk about that movie.
That movie defies the tradition.
Yes.
So David here is, you know, he's trying to be as human as he could be, it seems like, at the beginning, because he's dyeing his hair. And isn't that what he was doing? It looked
like the inference to me is that he's been awake on the ship for the 2-year journey while everyone's in hypersleep. And to me, it's like he's been watching Lawrence of Arabia over and over and over and over again to model himself after that character. And he, like, everything he knows about how humans act is informed by Lawrence of Arabia, apparently.
Which is strange that their DVD selection would be so limited. It's like, why don't you just watch all of them, guy? You got two years.
They didn't show the scene of David watching Biodome. Or, Police Academy Mission to Moscow.
You don't want him going around saying Gutenberg lines throughout the
movie. No. Man, that would have been an interesting Fassbender performance.
That
Michael
would have been.
Fassbender.
What the fuck is he doing?
Michael Fassbender as Michael Winslow from Police Academy making all the sound effects.
Oh, that would have been good. Ridley Scott would have been like, what are you doing, boy?
Fassbender can do anything, right?
Now, that's interesting. See, Fassbender in this role, when I see him, now whether he's following orders or not, from the very beginning, just the look of him, either the way that he's being directed to act or the way that he's just portraying this character, I felt like he had something else going on from the beginning.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so I never really felt like he was somebody that the crew could trust or that the audience could trust. and he's always sort of running off on his own once they get on the planet, and he's like pushing buttons and shit, and you're like, what are you doing, guy? Like, you could be killing these people.
Right, and I think that may just be to the point where Ridley Scott concedes that anyone who knows the Alien franchise is going to suspect the android of something right off the bat, so you might as well make no bones about it.
Right. Now, see, I didn't ever feel that way when I saw Lance Hendrickson for the first time. And that was the second one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ripley sure did, though.
Yeah, she did, and I was like, I don't know, Lance Hendrickson, he always dies in every performance. I'm sure he'll do something, and it'll be heroic, I guess.
And he does. And they do a fake-out at the end of that movie where they make you think that Bishop has ditched her and Newt to die on the planet, but then he comes back and I've never, even when I saw that movie when I was like 8 or 9 years old, and I never really bought that fake out even then.
Mm-hmm.
But
so I don't know. How do you think Fassbender does just as a performance compared to the other androids?
Compared to the other androids?
Well, yeah. I mean, just as in this performance, like as the sort of legacy of being androids, like the rest of the Alien movies.
He's the only one of the four that is hands down the most interesting thing about the movie.
Now, that's either a really good job by him, or the other movies didn't really care enough to make him interesting, or this was the best thing the movie had going for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the android character is more relevant to this movie because the movie is about creation.
Mm.
And at the end of the film, when they wake up the engineer who's been in hypersleep for 2,000 years, they try to talk to him, and the second David opens his mouth, it's like the engineer knows that's not something that I made.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have wondered, why does the engineer try to kill David right away? And to me, that's just it. It's like he thinks he's an abomination.
Right. It's not like, from him.
Right. And there's nothing, I guess, noble about the creation of David. It's more of a hubristic, is that a word?
It's more
of an act of hubris to create David,
mm-hmm.
because it didn't require any sacrifice. And I think that's what the opening scene shows, that these engineers, to create life, they have to sacrifice themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the humans didn't sacrifice anything to make David. They made David because they could.
Right,
and
which is exactly the line from when they're playing pool, they're throwing those pool balls around.
Which also reminded me of Jurassic Park, interestingly enough.
Oh, sure.
The line where he's like, your scientists were so preoccupied with wondering if they could do it, they didn't bother to wonder if they should do it.
Yes, Jeff Goldblum.
Yes, and who doesn't love Jeff Goldblum?
That movie is so underrated, I feel like. I feel like that's one of those where they think of it more as the visual effects achievements than anything else. But Jurassic Park's a hell of a movie.
Jurassic Park is, and when we talked about Sunshine, I think it belongs in that same class where it's such a perfectly constructed screenplay and has so many ideas going on in it in the service of this really fantastic thriller that Jurassic Park was like an afterthought movie for Steven Spielberg, and it's one of the greatest movies ever made. That was like Spielberg at the peak when even his afterthoughts were unbelievable movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have the main cast, and they end up getting on the planet, and they're checking everything out, and they have, you have your Star Trek red shirts, your guys that you know are going to get killed. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about that I wanted to talk about was that I don't know what this guy's name was. I don't remember his name, but he's the redheaded Mohawk guy.
That is Fifield.
Okay. And he is he's kind of like the jerk off, but he's kind of, he seems to be the tough guy at the beginning part of the movie. Right?
Yeah, because he has that line to the guy that ends up being his partner, basically,
mm-hmm.
that I've just been asleep for 2 years, I don't really care to get to know you, or something
right,
like that.
Right, yeah. He just wants to make his cash and get out of there.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of playing the tough guy, but then when it comes down to it, he's not a tough guy at all.
No. Not only is he not a tough guy, but he's a fucking idiot on top of it. One of the coolest things in the whole movie are he has these little probes that can roll along the wall, and they map the whole facility. So he's ostensibly the map maker, and he's the one who gets fucking lost.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
That whole part, everything in the movie involving that character should be cut.
It seemed like it was everything. To me, it seemed like it was two different guys, and they just put him into one guy.
Yes, I think that's possible, too.
Because they have him being the asshole, but then at the same time, they try to make him more sympathetic, like when he's lost and he's trying to figure things out.
Right. I mean, the setup for this is just, it's ridiculous. They finally find what they were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And they find the dead body of an engineer, and they find the temple, for lack of a better word. And this guy is like, fuck it, I'm out of here. And the other guy goes with him, and then they go away. You would think at that point that the captain would be expecting them to come back to the ship.
Mm-hmm.
That they would be in contact and say, we're on our way back. But they're just totally forgotten about. Then there's a storm, there's like some kind of huge dust storm coming, so they evacuate and they all go back. And that's when they realize that the other two guys never went back to the ship.
Yeah, because they got lost.
And it's just like, that whole passage, when they get lost, they run into the first creatures that you see in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole passage of the movie feels like Fox executives were looking at the script and said, there's like 25 pages here where nothing exciting happens.
Mm. It's like the trailer formula.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, well, there's a lot of talking about God here, and they find some things, but it's creepy, but nothing really happens, so we need something to happen here.
Punch it up.
Yeah, and that totally feels that way, that whole stretch of the movie. And, like, there's even this really lame thing where the Mohawk guy, Fifield, is smoking pot in his respirator.
Yes.
He's
got his little bong in his respirator, and you're like, okay.
That totally flummoxed me. I was like, what? That was like, that felt like a studio note too. Like, we need a laugh somewhere in this movie. Hey, stoners are probably going to see this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't feel like it belonged in the movie at all.
No, I completely agree.
The weakest thing about the movie is anything involving that Fifield character.
Yeah. And one of the things that I thought was really well done is when you finally get the end of those two characters.
Yes.
Now you get them and they find their way back to the tomb. Or whatever you want to call it, with all the vases and the black goo.
Yeah.
And then you've got this sort of snake-looking Jurassic Park thing that got Newman-looking thing.
Dilophosaurus.
There we go.
Spared no expense.
And so you have a thing that looks like that and a snake kind of combined.
Yeah.
And this one dumbass is like, yeah, this doesn't look scary. I'll just fuck around with it.
Yeah, he's like, oh, it's beautiful. I'm like, God damn it.
You're like, I'm sitting there like pulling my head away from the screen going, oh, no, like some shit's going to happen to you. Which I think is, you know, I'm invested enough in the film to where at least I was like, oh, God, you dumbass. Now you're going to get it. And then that whole sequence to where, yeah, it kills one of them for sure. And the other one, you know, sort of comes back. But it kills them as they were. But it doesn't really do it very quickly. And it kind of, you know, fucks it up before it kills them, for lack of a better term. Because, you know, it's messing around with the arm, and then they're trying to figure out exactly how to get it off of his arm. And
yeah. And then it just goes right through his mouth.
Yeah, and then it goes into his mouth and into his suit.
And I guess I think the other character's name is Milburn.
Okay.
The nerdy guy.
Yeah. The actual scientist-looking guy.
Yes. So, like, the snake ends up going down his throat, and I think you're supposed to think that it laid some kind of eggs in it, because when they find his body, something jumps out of his throat, and I don't think it's the same creature. So the life cycle of this of this goo
uh-huh.
is very confusing. Because there's the creatures of all different sizes that gestate into other creatures of all different sizes, and so you have to wonder: does what happened to the goo depend on the host's thinking or attitude or the atmosphere? Or it's all very nebulous.
Yeah, I guess the way that I took it was that black stuff. Once it got into the sort of creators, then it became the pre-alien alien.
Yeah.
Then it gets into other stuff and it sort of slowly evolves. But if it just jumps straight into humans, it's not really the same thing.
No. Yeah, because I wonder if... So Holloway drinks some champagne with a drop of the goo in it.
Yeah, now that thing when that comes up, and you see the way that David handles the glass.
Yes.
I wanted so badly for that to be more subtle than it was.
Yes, it wasn't very subtle at all.
He sticks his whole goddamn finger in there.
Yeah.
And very traumatically lifts his finger out.
Yeah, they couldn't have had him squeeze his finger against the side of the glass or something.
Well, it couldn't have been when he's pouring it, just dip his finger in there and then turn and give it. I mean, it was like, I'm putting something in here.
Yeah, there are a few. There's another moment later where Charlize Theron has this dramatic pause and calls the character Father.
Oh, yes.
And it's yes, we get it. I think we all figured that one out.
Yeah, I was sitting there waiting for it, and I got maybe to where David was talking to him, and I was like, oh, there's probably someone else alive on here that no one knows about. And I was like, I bet you that must be Vickers' dad.
Yep.
Because I remember Sean saying father. And I was like, that's got to be what it is.
There you go. Oh, that's right. I mentioned that the last time, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's not like I was like, oh, no.
I mean, that's kind of a slam dunk.
Yeah. Have you seen Werner Herzog's Cave of Forgotten Dreams?
I have. I saw it a few months. I just was talking about it yesterday, actually.
Have you noticed that Ridley Scott has also seen it? Because that's the cave that I find at the beginning.
I did. I thought of that yesterday when I was talking about Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, Prometheus kind of looks like that in the first five
minutes. It's the horses that all look the same.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, well, apparently someone besides me saw this documentary. And his name is Ridley Scott.
How would you like to have seen Werner Herzog in this movie? That would have been interesting.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's one of those where I wish I could do accents, because I'd do a Werner Herzog in an alien-based movie. That would be hilarious.
I mean, if Werner Herzog had played Wayland, on board you'll find David, who is like a son to me. I don't know how good that was.
Timothy Treadwell,
who thought that he was a friend to bears, but found otherwise when the bear friend ate him for dinner.
What a dumb fuck that guy is.
That guy was the dumbest fuck of all fucks.
Never have I rooted for a bear in a movie.
Until Grizzly Man.
Yeah. Oh, I just liked that movie, though. I was like, holy shit, this is something else.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good. I really like Werner Herzog movies when they don't have Nicolas Cage in them.
You know, that movie was, that was something, wasn't it?
Bad Lieutenant, boy, that is, that's something else.
I think everyone was on hallucinogenics when they made that movie.
Wow, that's strange. And Werner Herzog loves him some lizards.
He does. He loves some lizards, and apparently he told Nicolas Cage to do anything that came into his head.
Hey, Nicolas, you remember what you were like in Face Off, right? I want that times 10.
Hey, Nicolas, remember when you were really young and you probably did a lot of coke? Well, let's do that again.
You know you're a Coppola, right? So I know you've done a lot of coke. Okay, so more about Prometheus. let's move farther along. So we've got the two sort of red shirts, the two sort of cannon fodder have been killed, and we actually haven't talked about Elizabeth Shaw that much.
No. And I think that kind of speaks volumes about how good of a character she is, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, I think I liked her more than most just because I thought she was pretty realistic. And so the note that I have is, for me, Ripley, the iconic Aliens character, is a combination of Vickers and Shaw.
I think that's spot on.
And so she is, you know, Charlie Theron. Hell of a good looking woman named Charlie. Charlize Theron is, you know, she's this cold, almost robotic, as Yanis asks her.
Yeah.
Which that actually had me for a minute. I was like, wait a minute. You know, she actually really is like that.
I think there's a lot more of, I think I had read that originally that was intended to be a much bigger plot point in the movie. Whether they filmed it or not, there was originally supposed to be a lot of material in the movie dealing with whether or not Vickers is an android.
See, I really liked that, actually. Like, I thought I was more, you know, I gravitated more to that storyline than I did the whole God stuff.
Yeah.
And I think anytime you can see Charlize Theron running around in like a skin-tight suit, I've got all the time in the world for that.
Yeah, that was something, too. That was quite an introduction to her character, where she's basically wearing, you know, the Lilu Dallas multipass outfit, doing some push-ups covered in cryogenic fluid.
Yeah,
that she's a good time.
And, so she's got that kind of hardened, you know, spacesuit, skimpy sort of skin-tight outfit on throughout this. And what's funny is the last movie I had seen her in was Young Adult.
Yes.
And I was like, wow, you looked like crap in part of that movie. Because, I mean, she's obviously supposed to.
Yeah.
But in this, I was like, holy shit, like, she looks really good. And I sort of forgot about her after Aeon Flux. I was kind of like, yeah, Charlize, you blew it. But
And then she won an Oscar after that.
Well, I thought Monster was before that.
I don't know. Was Aeon Flux the token post-Oscar piece of shit?
Aeon Flux was that MTV movie where she had the black hair.
Right, I just try to remember when that came, but
I'm pretty sure that was after Monster.
I think Charlize Theron is forgotten by a lot of moviegoers, quite honestly.
She's good, I think.
She is very good, but there's something of her career has been so strange, and I think a lot of times the big movies she's in are not perhaps the best movies. But then she's in smaller things like Young Adult or...
What did you think of that movie?
I didn't like Young Adult very much because I need somebody to like in the movie. I didn't like any of them. I didn't like a goddamn person in that movie.
That is a risk. I like
the most interesting character in that movie is Patton Oswalt's sister, who's in one scene.
Yeah, she's towards the end.
Yeah, she's like, "Take me with you." Right. Isn't that basically the thrust of that scene?
Yeah, she wants her to take her with her, and she tells her no.
Like, if the movie had been about Patton Oswalt and his sister, it would have been a much better movie, I think. But that's, you know.
The wife and I actually enjoyed that movie. It's because I think my sort of worldview is so cynical.
Yeah.
Whether I want it to be or not, I sort of was like, oh, yeah, you know, if I multiply my worldview times a million, I can see where it's coming from. You know, so I was like, oh, yeah, I get that. I get that sort of, I'm an asshole and I like it sort of a thing.
Yeah, but I think the thing with that movie was I kind of went in expecting it to be more of a comedy.
Oh, okay.
And there are parts that are funny, but the whole time you're like, she's really not likable. And then the big confrontation happens, and all of a sudden the movie, you're like, oh, this is a very tragic movie.
Yeah, because that's such an awkward scene.
It is. Like you feel embarrassed for everyone in the movie.
Yeah. It just lingers too.
Yeah, it goes on and on and on.
Oh God, just get off of this scene already.
I do wonder what I would think of the movie seeing it a second time when I know what to expect.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I would like it more.
I had heard a couple of reviews, so I sort of knew like the tone.
Yeah.
So I guess I had a bit of an advantage to where I knew it wasn't going to be like a regular, like I knew it was going to be a little darker than like the Juno or whatever else Jason Reitman had done. So
yeah, the thing that really bothered me about that movie was there had to be like 65 product placement shots in that movie, which I Jason Reitman could probably make a pretty convincing argument that he was making a point about, you know, the homogenization of the suburbs and all this.
Uh-huh.
But it was just, it was a nonstop assault of product placement.
Yeah, it really was.
Which one thing that endears me to Prometheus is that by its very nature, there is no product placement in it.
Oh, look at that transition back.
Did you like that? Outside of the name on the basketball and the fact that he's watching Lawrence of Arabia,
yeah,
that's about it.
That's true. Well, and it's not like it goes out of its way to announce that it's Lawrence of Arabia either.
Well, no, not at all.
But yeah, so going back to it. So we have Elizabeth Shaw as our main character. We have David as sort of your foil, your guy that introduces the black goo to the human race.
Yeah.
And then you have some brutal choices by Vickers when the Prometheus needs to be shut or not shut.
Yes.
And that was fine. And then when they finally tell him to burn that fucker, I was like, holy shit. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if I know where this is going now.
That was, I kind of expected that to happen, but the way that it was done and the fact that Holloway himself asks for it, I thought that that was a really very effective and shocking scene.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't, I mean, and the fact that it's Charlize Theron doing it, I think helps to make it more shocking too.
Right, and she has no problems with doing it either.
No, she's just like, fuck it.
It's like, all right, yeah. She's like, this is what I was wanting to do anyway.
And that's very, you know, that if they had done that at the beginning of Alien, they wouldn't have had all these troubles. Because
right.
Remember, Ripley doesn't want to let him back in after Kane has the face hugger and Ash goes down there and opens it against her orders.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like the inverse of that. Like, this time we are going to play it by the book, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
You're fucked anyway. Yeah. Literally fucked, because she did get fucked, and now she's going to give birth to an alien.
Yep. Now, what did you think about Shaw when she's struggling with the fetus? What did you think about that scene?
I think the actual operation scene is, I mean, you're never going to forget that scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's more, almost the more effective thing about, more effective than what she's doing and the gore is how claustrophobic it is under in that capsule. And you can just kind of feel the sweat in there.
Oh yeah.
Like the sound design and everything about that sequence is perfect.
Yes. I feel hot and claustrophobic just thinking about it.
Yes. Like that's almost worse than the fact that she, you know, extracts an alien octopus from her body and then staples herself together.
Yes.
The second time I saw this movie, I took my dad to see it, who loves gory stuff and horror movies. And when the staples start going in, my dad in the middle of a packed theater goes, "Holy fucking shit." He was like aghast that was happening.
Well, yeah, it's so brutal.
Yeah.
Because you know, you have David and he's trying to basically, I don't know if he's trying to learn or what exactly he's doing.
Yeah.
And Shaw sort of chickens him and runs off. And that's where I'm like, that's when I see the Ripley in her. Is
yes.
When she's, you know, being independent and being strong and being not relying on other people. And she gets in there and you're like, oh, all right, it's going to be okay. She's in this thing that they've obviously alluded to. And then it says it's only for males.
Yes.
And you're like, what? Well, now she's fucked is what I was thinking. And I'm like, they've got enough big names in this cast where I was sort of like, well, is she really going to make it or not?
Oh, really? Wow.
She's not that big of a name. And yeah, she's the main character, but Is she going to be debilitated somehow, or what's going on?
Yeah, and it turns out that instead of being debilitated, she's able to, you know, put on a spacesuit and go on another adventure.
Yeah.
Which
so
I guess...
Not only does she have the thing extracted from her, which, for whatever reason, she thought that it died, but it didn't.
Yeah, it's never addressed.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was like, what is that?
They like, she seals it in the pod and hits some, like, a button that says decontaminate or something.
Right, like, I thought it was like a sterilization or decontamination or something.
And then it's never even addressed. The next scene, she finds David waking up Peter Wayland, and she's covered in blood and half naked, and nobody says anything.
Yeah.
And, like, this whole time, you have no idea where Charlize Theron's character is.
Mm-hmm.
And don't you think she would know, she would want to know if there was a giant octopus in her quarters?
Yes, in her little escape pod thing.
Yeah. From that point of the movie on, there are so many holes.
That's got to be where the 30 minutes is, for me. Like, I hope that's where it is.
Yes, because, yeah, they never address the fact that Shaw is covered in blood. Mm-hmm. They never address the fact that there's an alien squid on board. Like, Shaw, I think they pulled it off in convincing me that Shaw could still function after that, because they show her repeatedly stabbing herself with, like, those little medical, like, you know, it's like a Star Trek trick. You get a piece
hypo
of...
Hyposprays.
Yeah, hyposprays. Like, she stabs herself with, like, the Prometheus equivalent of a hypospray, like, three times. And you're like, okay, I guess that's how they're going to get away with it.
And they sort of lasered it, so it was, like, cauterizing as she was...
Yes.
As she was cutting herself. And then
exactly.
What was strange was that those staples were some big motherfuckers.
Yeah, I do think it's funny that, yeah, like we have all these futuristic advances, but nope, still staples.
Yeah, it would. I mean, come on. It's like Crusher would just go run a thing across and it would...
Exactly. But, you know, that I'm sure that was a decision made because it was the most terrifying thing that could happen.
Oh, yeah.
After all that, the last blow is, and now she has to staple herself together.
It was a squirmy deal for me, for sure. And I was like, ooh, no, thank you.
Yeah. I had heard that the scene where they were going to one-up the chestburster, attempt to one-up the chestburster, the original movie, was also going to be a birth-type scene. And what I had pictured was going to happen in this movie was way worse than what actually happened. I was like, they're not going to have, like, an alien come out of her.
Oh, like an actual birth.
Yeah.
See.
I don't know.
Hmm.
So I don't know. That could have been. Well, I guess they did stuff like that in Species, didn't they?
I've successfully avoided that franchise.
It's disgusting and stupid, but there's a lot of boobs in it.
Well,
I think that sums it up perfectly, really.
I think the wife will probably be out of town one of these days.
There you go.
Netflix, here we go.
That's a movie, if you see Species on cable or something, you will be shocked when you see who plays the young version of the main character. I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, all right. Tantalizing.
There's a little teaser for everybody out there.
There we go. So we have so Shaw's running around, and she's and you know, in the meantime, they come across sort of like a hybrid from the alien controlled human.
Yes, it's like he's kind of a alien goo zombie, I guess.
Yeah, it was like he's a zombie. That's what I thought immediately. I was like, well, he's a zombie, so just stab him in the head.
Yeah.
But he's not dying when you burn him.
No.
And so I was like, what the hell? Like, yeah, it's like thinning out the crowd. But I was like, well, what's the point? Like, is this going to come up later again or not really?
And it doesn't. Yeah. That's again, you know, and that's it involves the same character, the Fifield character, where it just totally feels like, we need something. We need another action beat here.
Well, it's strange because when the boyfriend scientist guy gets burned, he sort of croaks.
Yeah.
But then when this clown gets burned, he like it doesn't really work.
No, they have to run him. They have to run his skull over with an ATP or whatever.
With the freaking
APC.
With the what? Yeah, like the Batmobile looking thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think James Cameron called it an APC in his Alien movie, like an armored personnel carrier or whatever. Oh, I'm getting all nerdy over here. I know.
Yeah. And so we get, the reintroduction of the of sort of David being up to no good and his the person he's been taking orders from the whole time. And it is, Sean. It is Mr. Guy Pierce.
It is. Perhaps inexplicably, it is Guy Pierce.
Yeah, it's like, wouldn't you think he's going to... I mean, maybe he just worked for scale in this movie.
I don't know. I just... They did some viral video type things where Guy... were set, like, in the 2030s or something, where Guy Pierce was able to appear without old man makeup.
Oh.
But... every time you see him in this movie, he's in this old man makeup, and there's no reason for it.
Yeah.
And why didn't they just... So unless they plan on reintroducing him in Prometheus's, or if there's, again, more of him on the cutting room floor,
yeah.
It just comes off... It just... To most people watching this movie, like, why the hell is Guy Pierce in this in old man makeup?
Yeah, and I didn't get it. Like, I guess, I understand that he was trying not to die.
Yeah.
But I was like, I don't get it. Like, it's an interesting enough story, but I don't know if it's like a movie-worthy story to where he's just trying not to be old. Like, okay.
Well, and I think that plays into what I was talking about before, where it's like the engineers are kind of offended by the hubris of the human race.
Okay,
like,
that makes sense.
You don't get to unnaturally extend your life.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do with it, you know, you are given this life for a purpose, and that's not it.
Right, and so you get the reveal that he's sort of, you know, they say early on that he's dead.
Yes.
Or they imply it at least. And then you get the reveal that David's sort of been taking care of him, and he's there, and he's got these doctors that you never see again.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if they were the same ones. I don't know if his doctors were the same ones that Shaw apparently knocked out, even though they had metal helmets on. She wakes up and like takes out these doctors and then runs to the med pod and does surgery on her, but those doctors don't chase her.
And they're like, so oh, it's like, shit. She's
so
nice.
Between getting knocked out by Shaw and Shaw doing the operation, did David say, oh, we're going to wake up Wayland now? You know, hey, never mind the woman who's got an alien squid growing inside of her. We're gonna go wake up the boss.
Right. And so we get that makes sense. And so Waylon sort of goes back into the Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Well, the parent of the Cave of Forgotten.
Yes.
And we see the original engineer or whatever you want to call him, and then we get sort of the final, like the final act, I guess, to where you get the original character, the god persona, woken up.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as we alluded to earlier, as you mentioned earlier, he seems sort of okay, like he's fairly calm. And then once David starts talking to him, he loses his shit.
Yeah.
And just starts destroying everything.
Yeah, and which a lot of people who didn't like the movie are saying the movie presents us these god figures, and the first thing they want to do is throw us around like we're in a wrestling ring.
Yeah, but that's like not right. Like, I understand that argument, but that's not what the movie's saying.
No, it's not.
I mean, I guess it's valid as any other interpretation, but for me, that's not what I read it as saying.
No.
And I think I give Damon Lindelof a little bit more credit than that. You know, he's upset because it's David.
Right.
Not, you know, if Meredith or Elizabeth or any of the people, you know, that would have or could have been down there would have been speaking the language.
Yeah.
I feel like that wouldn't have been the same situation.
Well, and I want to say that someone did ask the movie's, like, linguistics advisor what David says to the engineer.
Uh-huh.
And I'm Googling it right now. Cause there's an art, cause I read the article, and I think that it kind of speaks to what we had talked about earlier as far as the engineer thinking that it was an abomination. And here, okay, what the, Dr. Anil Biltu of the SOAS Language Center in London, who served as the linguist teacher on Prometheus, says that this is a Collider.com article, reveals that David said was, quote, "This man is here because he does not want to die. He believes you can give him more life," unquote. So it's like doubly offensive to the engineer. Someone wants to unnaturally extend their life, and he's being told this by an abomination of nature.
I see. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Why don't they subtitle that?
I don't know. Well, that goes to this whole notion that Lindelof and Ridley Scott wanted to make something that was ambiguous. And Lindelof has said in many interviews that more often than not, he was basically taking marching orders from Ridley Scott, that this was the movie Ridley Scott wanted to make, and he wanted people to think about it and didn't want to spell it all out for them.
Hmm.
But, and you could, I'm guessing if you asked Ridley Scott if he thought that it worked, that he would say it did work, because people are definitely talking about the movie.
Yeah, I guess I remember when we first talked, you know, there's no discussion in a perfect film.
Right, exactly.
And this is not a perfect film, but there's a lot of room for discussion.
Yes, and I think the biggest question that the movie poses that they don't really readdress after... Obviously, Shaw wants to know why the engineers decided to kill... They wanted to go back to Earth to kill the human race.
Mm-hmm.
And the only real clue that the movie gives you is right when they get to the temple and they find this really neat, like, holographic recording that shows the, like, holograms of the engineers running through the tunnels. And, they try to figure out how long ago that was. And they have this little thing that's able to do carbon dating in like 2 seconds. And they determine that the dead engineer body has been there for about 2,000 years.
Mm.
Well, if the movie takes place in 2093 and it was about 2,000 years ago that the human race did something that pissed off the engineers. So then you start to wonder, so was Jesus an engineer? And if so, how silly of an idea is that? Ridley Scott has said as much that was specifically spelled out at one point in the script.
Oh, okay.
And they decided against it because they thought it was too on the nose. And I think too on the nose is a really kind way of saying it was just too fucking silly.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was going to say, that's not really, like, I heard them say 2,000 years ago, but by then, yeah. I think I had forgotten what year it was.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have put it together.
Yeah, I didn't put it together when I first saw it either. And then I was reading articles and I saw it a second time, like, oh, yeah, they specifically say like 2,000 years when they talk about how long ago it was.
Huh.
So.
Where the fuck's his beard and his long ass hair?
I know, right? Instead, he looks like he looks like Atlas, for God's sake.
Yeah. Goddamn Bible.
Yes, this is a very curious movie to watch when you're an atheist.
All right, back to Prometheus. So what else do we have to say about Prometheus here, Sean?
Well, let's see. We've talked about Damon Lindelof. We've talked about Space Jesus.
Yep, Marble Jesus.
Marble Space Jesus. I think I've mentioned all the things that really bother me about it. The thing is, I'm bothered by so much in the movie, but I find that it didn't really hurt my enjoyment of it. And I don't know if that's just because I like Alien and Aliens so much that I'm just so excited to have another movie that's up to that same level,
mm-hmm.
especially after Alien Resurrection,
or if
it's just that I'm a huge Ridley Scott fanboy, which I kind of am, you know. Body of Lies and A Good Year notwithstanding.
Now, wait a minute.
Not that those are bad movies, but they're not, you know, they're not exactly, you know, Body of Lies feels like a Tony Scott movie.
Absolutely right.
And Goodyear feels like, you know, something they did as a lark on a weekend.
A Goodyear feels like dog shit is what it feels. Yeah, it was one of those where I was like, all right, Russell Crowe, Ridley Scott. And then I was like, what is this?
Yeah, Ridley Scott proved in that movie that he should not make comedies.
Mm-hmm.
As enjoyable as parts of that movie are just for, like, kind of looking at it, and the, you know, it has a lot of actors that I like in it, but Jesus Christ, it's like it should have been about 85 minutes long.
Yeah, it's like stick to the big budget science fiction, you know, big spectacle type movies.
Yeah.
And
which
Tony Scott, I really can't. I mean, outside of like your Top Guns, and didn't he do like Days of Thunder also?
Yes, he did.
I think other than the Tom Cruise vehicles, I don't know that I've really enjoyed him as well.
The only Tony Scott movie to me that even approaches the best of
Man
what
on
his
Fire or whatever.
Man on Fire.
Yeah.
Man on Fire is this perfect movie where all of Tony Scott's masturbatory tendencies actually work.
Yeah, it's because it's that dirty, sweaty Mexico.
Yes, that's part of it. But it's just like Denzel Washington's character in that movie is so tortured. And you believe it, and the kind of fractured. I think that's a good way to put it. Like Tony Scott's movies have this kind of fractured aesthetic lately, and that really it really works for Man on Fire, especially when the girl is kidnapped. You're just like, dude, this guy's like you believe that guy would go on a murderous rampage after that.
You know, that's one of those where Man on Fire is the perfect Punisher movie that Marvel Comics will never make.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Because that's what he is.
Yeah, but you're right, aren't you?
But that's not what the comic book fans or that's not what the studio will make.
So what, Punisher Warzone, no good?
Oh my god. Fucking McNulty from The Wire. He's got this, he's a British character, and he's got this horrible Brooklyn accent. Oh, Dominic West, what are you doing?
You gotta see, not see. Have you heard of a podcast called How Did This Get Made?
Oh, no, but I want to subscribe based on the name.
It's on Earwolf, and it's Paul Scheer, who is from the Upright Citizens Brigade, or Human Giant, or maybe both. He's from the L.A. comedy school, basically. Mm. And he and his wife and this guy, Nick Mantzoukas, who's on The League and who's a comedian.
You know, I've heard great things about The League because it has the Duplass brother in it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, Mark Duplass, I think.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he does. He's done like The Puffy Chair and Jeff Who Lives at Home. And he did.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he did that. He's in that Safety Not Guaranteed that just came out.
Yes, which looks like a fantastic
movie. Yeah, it looks really good, actually. I do like me some What's-Her-Face from Parks and Rec.
Oh, Aubrey Plaza.
Yes.
The sexy Puerto Rican. Hello.
Yes.
Hello,
friend. Ew, anyway, so.
What was I saying? Oh, yeah, so they do this podcast called How Did This Get Made, and every episode is them talking about a terrible movie. And one of the episodes is what the hell were we talking
Punisher
about?
Warzone.
Punisher Warzone. And they have Patton Oswalt on with them talking about it, and they have the director of the movie on talking about it.
It's like, it's Lexi something? Is
Lexi name? Alexander, yeah. I think is her name. And she's hilarious. And when she talks about the movie, she talks about all the things that she wanted to do with it. And Patton Oswalt and the people on the podcast love the movie.
Really?
Like, for how bad it is, basically.
Oh, okay.
That's a must listen. That episode,
that up.
How did to plug another podcast?
Yeah.
How Did This Get Made? The Punisher Warzone episode, and then even better than that is the Superman 3 episode, where the special guest is none other than Damon Lindelof. See, it all comes back to Prometheus.
That movie's so bad. With evil beard Superman
and Richard Pryor.
And Richard Pryor straight from the toy.
Yeah, skiing with a robe on or whatever.
Oh, the quest for peace is worse, but that is a bad movie.
Yes, that's like you could have a bad movie death match, and those could be the those could be the finalists.
Oh, Jesus!
even Wild Wild West looks at Superman 4 and goes, "Shit!"
Wild Wild West.
Ooh, fuck Wild Wild West
too.
It is. It's the worst.
All right. What else you got, Sean? Any other Prometheus thoughts?
My last thought is that if they are setting us up for a sequel, they better damn well make it. And the problem with that is that Ridley Scott is 74 years old, and he's the kind of guy who doesn't sit around. Mm-hmm. He always has. He's not as bad as Guillermo del Toro in this regard, but it always seems like Ridley Scott announces five projects for every one that he does.
And he always announces them like 10 years before it gets made. It seems like.
Yeah, like he's not. It's not like Guillermo del Toro where I mean you can't even believe anything the guy says. They have apparently filmed Pacific Rim. I will not believe it until I see a trailer.
And a Hulk TV show.
Yeah, exactly. And he's supposed to make a new version of Disneyland's Haunted Mansion, a movie about for that, too. That's been talked about for like 5 years.
Look, don't fuck around with the Disney stuff when Sean's around.
That's right.
if you're going to make it, you better make it.
That's right. I mean, come on. The Eddie Murphy movie was an abomination.
Oh.
So they better damn well make it.
There you go.
And I don't know who's going to make I don't know who would make it if Tony Scott is no longer around to make it. And I don't know if the money's going to justify it. I just looked at the international numbers, and it's right around 289. That's total, domestic and foreign. So,
what did you say the cost was?
The cost is like 120.
Oh, okay. So it doubled it.
It doubled it, but you got to take into account advertising.
You normally say that like the advertising budget is usually like 30, like it's like 75% or like 3/4 of what the original cost was, I thought.
Yeah.
So they're still in the they're still in the black.
Then they're gonna make money on the Blu-ray for
sure.
Yeah,
you still got all the Blu-ray sales and stuff still too.
Yeah, which Blu-ray sales are down because everybody's going digital, but this is one people will buy to see the 30 minutes,
Oh, sure. Yeah, a Ridley Scott movie on DVD is going to sell. And one of the things I did want to mention before we start wrapping up is I've seen Blade Runner once, and I don't like it.
I'm with you. I admire Blade Runner.
Yes.
I think it's an unbelievably beautiful movie, and the practical effects from 1982 still look better than most CGI movies made in the last 10 years. But Jesus Christ, is that a hard movie to sit through?
Yeah, I watched it, and granted it was during the marathon stuff, so I watched it, and maybe I didn't give it the full attention that I needed to.
Right.
And I did put the final cut, and this other cut, and the fourth cut, and this other cut, and all that horseshit on my Netflix queue.
Yes, it is definitely horseshit.
And so I put all those extra cuts on there, but the regular original cut that I watched, I think I gave it 3 out of 5. I was like, it's fine, it's not offensive, but it didn't set my world on fire.
Is that the one with the voiceover still in it?
Yeah, it has the voiceover.
Yeah, that's the original theatrical version. I have never seen that. I've only seen the director's cut, which came out in like 1996, and then the final cut.
Okay.
To me,
I have both of those on the queue. We have actually gone to only streaming, so I don't know when I'll get to those. But yeah, it's one where I'd like to revisit it when I sort of have a weekend to just watch a bunch of Blade Runner, because I thought it was well done. Yeah. I liked the end a lot. Like, yes. I liked the sort of poetic discussion towards the ends and all that sort of thing. But I don't know. Maybe it's because I've seen all the movies that came from it to where I couldn't fully appreciate.
Yeah, that gets to be that. I think that's all. That's been a problem for any moviegoer in general. If you have been raised watching current movies, and then you see the movie that spawned everything you've seen in all the current movies,
yeah,
it's more of a thing where you respect the movie than you actually like it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like you can appreciate what it's done.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
Like I'm sure there are some teenage kids out there who saw Event Horizon and thought it was way better than Alien.
No, please.
Oh, Alien was boring. Event Horizon is so exciting.
Look, little kids, look it up in the dictionary. It's called suspense.
That's right.
You don't have to always show the thing that they're going against.
My sister put on Alien last night for the first time. She's never seen. She's seen the James Cameron one tons of times, and she fell asleep after like 20 minutes.
Oh.
She's like, I'm gonna give it another try. Put it on at like midnight, so we'll see. But yeah, she didn't make it too far.
Ridiculous. All right, Sean, you got anything else?
Oh, I think that about does it.
Okay, so look, here's the situation. This is a new show. We are trying a little something different from our regular format. So if you like this or do not like this, email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us over at Twitter. The show's handle is @plainlabelpod, and mine is @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page where you can like the show. Just search Plain Label Podcast, where you can also friend me under Eric Williams. Just like our regular show, we do have Amazon links to the film that we talked about here today over at plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com. If you click on those links and buy that movie, we do get some of that money at no additional cost to you. So we would love to hear what you think, so write us an iTunes review and tell others about the show. So before closing this one out, I would like to thank Sean again one more time for coming on the show and talking Prometheus with me. If people wanted to hear more from you, where would they find you on the internet?
They should go to Twitter at Sean Stangland DH. That's SEANSTANGLANDDH. Or if you're an enormous nerd about Disney parks, Disney movies, or Disney anything, you can follow Angry Disney Nerd at Twitter. And Angry Disney Nerd's getting pretty popular lately, actually.
Say what?
He's got lots of friends. He's not really that angry. He's actually pretty friendly.
Well, there you go. So go check out those two things if you want to see more of Sean. And I would wager a guess that this is probably not the last time we'll hear from you.
I would say that's correct.
All right. So thank you for listening. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with another film and another co-host.